Our Old Covenant reading in our text for tonight is taken from Job, chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 10. As I indicated this morning, we're going to look at Job's character and Job's situation as the adversary comes against him tonight. And then next week, we're going to look at the end of chapter 2 all the way through chapter 31, which sounds like a lot, because it is a lot, but there's a repetition here, and there's a theme that carries through it. And we'll see this, how this plays out in the dialogue, the interchange between Job and his friends, in quotation marks every time. And I chose the text or the theme for these 2 weeks for what may seem like an odd reason to begin with, but I think it bears strongly on how we do evangelism. What is it that we see, and what is it that we hear when we're interacting with others? And then how do we respond, and how ought we to respond? Of course, even more significant, is there something new that's being taught or spoken of in Job that, at least for Job and his contemporaries, is utterly foreign? And we don't know the date of Job, at least I don't know when it is, when it was written. Doesn't seem to be an Israelite. Very well may predate him. Don't know at what point in time. We know that he lived a long time after the end of Job, and he'd already had 7 sons and 3 daughters up till this time, so he probably was more than 36 years old. So how is it that, not being tutored by the law, that he then comes to worship God in the manner in which he does? And what is it that he has wrong with his approach to God? And what is it that God is teaching him? And what is it that he declares that is actually right in the midst of not having any previous instruction that might lead him to understand what the protevangelium was, you know, of Genesis 3, 15, 16, that is, the gospel, the promise of redemption through the seed of Adam and Eve. Anyway, that's the thinking behind this. So if this doesn't become clear as we go through next week, let me know and I'll try to clarify it and write longer paper. I have 43 pages written already for next week, which I plan to pare down. I told my friend, it's light out when I'm preaching, and most of the people are hoping it'll be light out when I'm done. So, anyway, having said that, by way of introduction, let's look at the text. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of feasts had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them. He would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Jacob fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands and his possessions and have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burnt up the sheep, and the servants consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness, struck the four corners of the house, and it fell among the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his clothes, shaved his head, and fell on the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord, saying, "From going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive the good from God? And shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. It's a story that you're well familiar with. And the outline of Job is fairly forthright. Just out of curiosity, do you get these notes emailed to you as well at night? Okay, just to understand, they're very, very rough. And there's some redundancy in there. When I was putting this together for a men's study that met early in the morning, I just put things together for people to work on. That's what I'm preaching off of. So be merciful as you read it. I may not be entirely literate, but I'm probably not entirely as bad as these notes represent. Well, I shouldn't say that because I wrote them, so I guess I am. But in any case, you saw the outline of this notes, how it lays out. In these first verses in chapter 1 and half of chapter 2, you see that Job's integrity is established. That three times it's mentioned that he was a person who was blameless and a person of integrity. What it is not saying is that he is sinless. What it's saying is that he is a person of integrity. And then after that, you come into a cycle of speeches. There's two complete cycles with Job's response to each one, to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They attack him with increasing vociferousness and with increasing vehemence, trying to lay him low. Zophar being far and away the most outspoken against Job. But even Eliphaz, who starts off very mildly, increases as the time goes on, and Job responds in kind. And then in the third cycle, Zophar is silent, Job responds to the two, and then there's a summary speech that's fairly lengthy and a final defense that Job gives before Elihu speaks and comes to the defense not of Job nor to attack Job, but to the defense of God's holiness and his glory, which in many ways is the theme of Job. It's the glory and the majesty of God and how that plays out. And when we'll see this next week, how when Job makes his appeal that there be an arbiter, somebody to stand between him and God, that he needs someone, that really is foreshadowing the very work of Christ, who stands in our place as our defendant and our advocate. So in any case, as you look at that, what I want to encourage you to do this week, if you've not already done so, is to read through the entire book of Job two or three times. If you have time, just do it in one sitting. If you can't do that, if time is constrained, because there are people that actually have to work, encourage at least to read this whole section and to read Elihu's response at least once. And that'll give you kind of the bigger overview. One of the things I find helpful as we approach the Word is to read things in sections and not to pay too much attention to chapter divisions. A number of years ago, I picked up something called the Reader's Bible. You're familiar with that. It's six volumes, no chapters, no verses, but there are divisions that are sectional as you go through it, with the exception of Psalms. That's chapter by chapter. And the thing that's nice about that is you're reading the whole section. So if you're reading, for example, the life of Abraham, you're reading the 12 chapters in Genesis about Abraham. If you're reading about Joseph, there are 12 chapters in there about Joseph and 12 chapters about Jacob. So you read that whole section together. And in a sense, that's really what you're doing here with Job and with those who are coming against him. But as you do it, keep in mind the very thing that has been stated in the introduction. And this is crucial to understanding everything that follows. Because as you read through Job, one of the things that will perhaps pop out to you, it sounds like Eliphaz's accusations are pretty much godly and on target, and the same with Bildad and Zophar. I mean, what they're saying seems to make sense. Why is it wrong, what they're saying? Why does the Lord come against them in the end? And what's forgotten is the very thing that is declared in the opening verses. There was a man in Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. And that's stated three times, twice by the Lord. He's making a statement very, very clearly. So as you're reading through this, you need to keep that in mind as you're looking at the accusations. Look at the big picture, but keep in mind the premise upon which it's built, upon who Job is. What is his integrity? What does it mean to be blameless? When the author is saying he's blameless, he's not saying he's sinless. There's a distinction. Rather, he's a man of character. He's very much, and you see this in Ezekiel, as he's talking about the defense before the Lord, that even if a person had the character or the integrity of a Noah or a Daniel or a Job, you couldn't stand. So here are characters in Scripture that are exemplified, and as you look in Scripture, other than the Lord Jesus Christ, who can you look at that's faultless? And indeed, even Noah is not faultless. Daniel, there's no account, I think, that can be laid at his feet. Or Joseph, who's not mentioned there, but again, one that seems to be exemplary in terms of his behavior. Or Nehemiah, although Nehemiah did get a little impatient and make him stand outside the walls until it got really hot. So it's kind of a little bit of in your face here. But other than that, you look at people and they're feet of clay. They're flawed in some fundamental way, but that's not said about Job. Job, it says, here he is. And then what follows on that? What does he say about Job? He says, well, he's rich. And God's blessed him. It sounds, and it's in the notes, almost like a prosperity gospel. If you do this, then God will do this. It's contractual. It's not covenantal in the way that it can be easily read. It's like if you just give me your seed money, if you watch any of those guys on TV, then God will bless you. You'll get more in return. You'll be able to drive cars like I drive, and you'll be able to buy your own jet plane. But until you give me the seed money so I can get a new jet plane, you can't get blessed. And it almost sounds as though that's what's happening here. That here is a man who is exemplary in his character. He's blameless. And so what happens as a consequence of that? He's blessed financially. He's blessed with a wonderful family. But that, again, is the premise upon which his interrogators attack him. They say, you're not being blessed now, so clearly something is wrong. But the way it starts out, we see this as part of the blessing that he has. But you see other things about Job's character. In fact, essentially you see his integrity, what kind of character he has as a person. How does he treat others? The reality is he's generous towards others. You'll see this next week as you go through Job's defense to his accusers. You see that he is godly and faithful and devout in his own relationship with God, not even trusting his own heart, knowing that there is, with this predilection to look at one's life and to say, well, I don't see anything that I'm doing which is actually wrong, but just in case my motivation is not entirely pure, let me make a sacrifice for the Lord. And certainly, I'll do that for my children, because they're partying on a regular basis, and I'm not sure that this partying is all on the up and up, and so I'm going to offer sacrifices on their behalf. So he's a devout man, and he's concerned not just for his own relationship with God, that it remain pure and undefiled, but he's concerned about his family, and he's concerned about others. And you see that he is a man who's moral in all of his behavior. So he's a man who's genuine, he's authentic. If you're doing business with Job, he would be one of those kinds of fellows you can say, "This is a handshake deal. We're no contract. We're just shake hands on it, and we'll go from there." When I left the church in the Midwest, I was in Moline for a very short period of time. I went to the church as a hatchet man, and didn't last long. And when the housing market was bad, it was back when the farm subsidies were being removed from John Deere and International and Case, and there was 25% of the houses in the Quad Cities were empty. There was a point in which unemployment was 40%. When I was there, it was well over 20% unemployment. And without going into the details, it was expedient for me to move on. And we had a house that we really liked. It was 2,700 square feet. It was brand new. I bought it from a bank for well below what it would cost to build. But with 25% of the houses on the market, there was no way to sell it. I called up a man in the church who had four children. He was an accountant and was living in a 900-square-foot home. And I said, "Would you like to buy my house? I'll sell it to you for what I paid for it, what I have in it." And he said, "Fine." And he didn't have the down payment, so "I'll give you the down payment. I'll loan it to you. Just pay me back whenever. I don't care. No interest. Just do it." He said, no, "I'll pay interest." I said, "I want interest." He said, "No, I'll pay it." I said, "Well, you pay whatever you want. I don't care." And it was a handshake deal. He said, "I'll pay it off in 2 years. I think he paid it off in 6 months or something. But it was somebody who was, I knew to be a person of integrity and honor. And you just trust them and you can move forward. That's the kind of person that Job was. Integrity, trustworthy, my word is my bond, and you move forward. And he had that reputation. People from all over came to him and looked to him for what he needed, for what they needed, because they knew that he would be their benefactor. Job had what some would say as an appearance of godliness. And the reason Job had the appearance of godliness is that he was godly. Sometimes people have an appearance of being one thing, but they're not. It's simply a facade. And sometimes that becomes apparent in short order, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's not till a point of crisis, and you're taken in. A lot of Ponzi schemes have been perpetrated on innocent people because a person seems to be one that's trustworthy and has character. I sold roofs for a short time. Very, very expensive metal roofs. Somebody I knew and who I really liked a lot had tremendous integrity and character. I just felt the Lord leading me in this direction to work with this guy who was an alcoholic. The thing about the company is I didn't know anything about selling. And so I bought a book on selling called The Little Red Book of Sales. And the number one thing to sell something is, what do you suppose? What do you sell first? Yourself. People don't buy from people they don't like. So you put yourself forward and you have some kind of transparency, at least a perceived transparency, a perceived honesty, and that people will believe you and buy from you. That's what it is. But you may have that and appearance, but not actually be true. The reason I went to work for my friend is when he was training me, we went up to this guy. We drove like 2.5 hours up to northern New Hampshire or whatever it was to see some old guy that had called in about a new roof. And we got there, and Patrick, my friend, said, "Gary, This guy doesn't need a roof. He called because he was lonely. So what he needs is to spend some time with you. So why don't you spend some time with him, and then we'll go home. And we're not going to sell him anything. He did this multiple times when I was with him. Because there was a genuineness there. Unbeliever, but a genuineness as a person. As in God's providence, over time, we were able to share the gospel with him. This is kind of an aside. And he came to faith, and he's been alcohol-free now for, I think, 5 years or more. The Lord really touched his life in extraordinary ways. And probably that was the only reason I actually went to work for this company for a short time. But my point is, there is an image of godliness, but it isn't true. I mean, Paul says of Satan that he appears as an angel of light. So it's no wonder people are deceived. Job wasn't that kind of person. What you saw was, in fact, what he was like, Daniel or Noah, that Ezekiel refers to in Ezekiel 14. Job was blessed. He had the number of completion in terms of sons, 7, 3 daughters. The temptation is easily to come here and to say this, that if we do this, that things that please God, that he will somehow bless us. And we want to put out what we think of as fleeces. That, Lord, if I tithe, like you say in Malachi, that my vats will be overflowing. You'll just bless me till I can't contain it. We think, I have a buddy of mine who's a Christian and sadly near the end of his life, like me, but he's in bad shape. He said, Gary, I tithe all the time because I expect God to bless me. I said, you know, it's not going to work that way, Lee. And he's still living in a trailer that needs a new floor and some other things. And it's possible. I mean, he's written some number of books, and a couple of movie producers are after some of them, though. But he'll probably die, and his children will inherit the millions that he'll get from the books that will be sold after he's dead. But we negotiate somehow, and somehow we expect God to barter with us. And that's not the issue. It's not even the issue that you're happy, which we'll see in Job. God is far more concerned about obedience than he is happiness in the frivolous sense of the word. Job, and you see this in the opening verses here, in terms of how he offers sacrifices, he sees the shadow in people. And this is what Job recognizes in and of himself. And it's one of the things that I want you to see as you progress through Job, is that you're not looking just at what's outward, but you're looking for something more. Oftentimes we communicate non-verbally. When I moved from the East Coast to the West Coast after graduating from seminary, I was with a friend who helped me move across the country. We were camping up at the Grand Canyon on the way out, and went to the chapel there on Sunday morning. And my friend was really sick. He had a horrible cold, wasn't feeling well. And the pastor was standing at the door, shaking hands with everybody, something I'm always loath to do. But anyway, my friend comes up, and he says, like he said to everybody in front of him, "How are you?" My friend said, "I'm doing terrible." And the man said, "Well, that's fine. That's nice." Because he wasn't listening. And he shouldn't have even had to ask the question. He shouldn't have been able to see it. I was preaching at my first church after seminary, and there was this lady in the pew who, something was wrong. I'd never seen her before. She was just visiting. And the end, it was back when they made me stand by the door and shake people's hands. And so I was shaking her hand and said, "How are you, lady?" And she said, "I'm fine." And I didn't let go of her hand. I said, "No, you don't understand. I'm asking how you are, and I don't think you're fine. I don't think you're telling me the truth." And she started to cry. But she was giving off signs all the way through the service. They were not, when she wasn't crying or weeping, but there were signs that things weren't right. What are we looking at? What are we seeing? When you looked at Job, you saw what was there in integrity, the true man. But oftentimes what you see is something else. And then how do you respond to that? Job knows what's in the heart, and he was looking at the hearts of his children and trying to respond accordingly. But anyway, Satan shows up on the door, and he comes, and when you look at the translation for this, it's Hasatan. I mean, it's the Satan, the adversary. It's a title that's given to this figure, the only one that in this council of God, and if you have the notes, you've seen something of how it is that something of how God governs the world is suggested in this section. Satan is, it's just his role, this is what he does. And the word Satan is always used relative to Lucifer or to the devil. I mean, it's what was used of the Lord when he stopped Balaam. And it was used with an accusation by Achish. Remember when he was dealing with David and said, "David will be our Satan. He'll be our adversary if you let him come with us." So it's the one who just stands and opposes you. We think in terms of God being all good and all powerful, but how is it that he's consorting with a being that represents and that is in fact evil? Now, understand that what he's talking about here is governance. He's not talking about fellowship. That somehow we're here and we're fellowshipping together, we're breaking bread together, and we're worshiping together. Satan isn't there to worship God. He's there to be an adversary to what it is that God has purposed, to question him. And God is concerned about his glory. That's the only thing that's an issue here. And so he's pointing to the man who is acknowledging that. And now he points to Satan. He says, "Well, look how faithful he is." And Satan says, "No, he isn't." And when you look at, and it's in the notes, but if you look at how the world is governed, you only have three essential types of rule in the world. You have that polytheism or animism, which oftentimes divides into kind of a duality, you know, a Zoroastrian kind of thing, and good and evil, whether there's a multitude of gods or whether there's just two gods, and they kind of vie for who's in control. And sometimes Christians come to this. There are times when they look at a text and they think that Jesus is offering up a sacrifice to Satan to satisfy him, which is, of course, heresy. Or they think about God in a monism kind of thing, that he's absolutely sovereign, like you do with Islam, that whatever it is he decrees. But then you have the dilemma of, well, if God is all good and all powerful, then how can there be evil in the world? How is it that he doesn't do it? What we see here in Job is that God uses secondary causality to govern, and that what is referred to in the New Testament, the prince of the air, or the prince of the power, that this is Satan on God's leash. It's like Martin Luther said, you know, Satan is God's Satan. He can do whatever it is that he permits you to do. And that Jesus himself, remember, and that was the text actually that I didn't read in Matthew, a Syrophoenician woman, when she comes before the Lord and he tests her faith. She's not a Hebrew. "I didn't come for you. I came for them." But she says, even dogs get to eat the crumbs from the table. And he commends her for her faith. So all of this is the testing of your faith. And this is precisely what's happening for Job. And the stage is being set for this in this section. The devil comes to take away the word in the parable of the sowers. In Romans 12, he says, "The testing, I appeal to you, brothers, therefore, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto the Lord, which is your reasonable or your spiritual form of worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, by testing what you may discern what is the will of God." Faith produces steadfastness. In James chapter 1, verses 3 to 8, it's exactly what he's talking about when he says that, "Count it all joy, brothers, you fall into various trials of various kinds, knowing that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness." It's the same thing that Peter is talking about. I mentioned this morning in 1 Peter 4, chapter 4, verse 12. All of this has to do with how it is that God uses circumstances in life to test us, to build us, to strengthen us, to establish us, and then to bring glory to himself. Because as you walk through the crucible, you do so in faith, trusting and believing that God is able to meet and will meet every need that you have. But then understand that much of what is spoken of eschatologically. That is, as we're talking about this morning, the present and the future, that there's a future kingdom, and that you're being prepared for you're going to spend eternity. You taste it now, according to Hebrews. But it's fulfilled. You'll feast on it then when you sit down around the table with the Lord Jesus Christ. The book of Job is not about suffering in general as much that is common to men and women, but how God treats his faithful servants. I mean, Jesus let Lazarus die. And when he got there, Martha said, "Well, if you had been here, wouldn't have died." Right, that's why he didn't come. But all of that set the stage for his own death and resurrection, that he has authority to lay his life down and to take it up again. All of this trial that one comes to and goes through is ultimately for the glory of God. You think about Philippians chapter 3, where Paul talks about himself being a Pharisee of Pharisees. He said, "I lay all of this down, put it all aside. I count it really as dung, as rubbish, that I might know Christ and be conformed to him." And when he talks about troubles and trials, he said, these are momentary troubles, momentary afflictions, and that we press on. It's passing. And the question is, do you have your eye fixed on what's before you? Like the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews 12, the author and the perfecter of your faith. So Job was faithful. But what we'll see is there is no reason that's discernible for why Job suffered. And what's really extraordinary is in all that follows in these next 29 chapters is that God is silent. Job is pleading and God is silent. Job is begging, he's suffering, he's in anguish, and God is silent. If you have an opportunity, read this week Psalm 44 and Psalm 88, where the psalmist cries out, "We didn't trust in the chariots. We didn't trust in our own strength. We trusted in you, and you're not saying anything. You're not doing anything. We have no plan B. If you don't come to our aid, there is no aid. There is no rescue. There is nothing. We will just die." If you go to my website on prayer, I have several sections, on one on the violence of prayer and another one on the silence of God in prayer. It's a frightening thing that when you hurt the most and you cry out, people are turning on you constantly, and everything is going the opposite of what you would anticipate it going for one who is faithful in serving the Lord, that there doesn't seem to be any answer. There doesn't seem to be any hope. And how then do you persevere through this dark night of the soul? How do you persevere to the dawn? It's faith. The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. You've tasted it once, so you know something of it. Job tasted it. And then there was adversity and silence. Until the dawn rose, the sun broke through, and Job saw something of God that he had never seen before.